Tonight, we are fortunate to have artist Valerie Haggerty here to speak on her fascinating work, from paintings and sculpture to installations and interventions that address themes of memory, place, and history, incorporating what she calls reverse archaeology. Now based in Brooklyn, Valerie received her MFA from the School of Art of the Art Institute of Chicago and a BFA from San Francisco Academy of Art College, a BA from Middleborough College in Vermont, and was recently the Andrew W. Mellon Arts and the Common Good Artist in Residence at Drew University in Madison, New Jersey for 2014-2015. Other residencies have included the LMCC, Marie Walsh Sharp, PS 122, Yaddo, and Smackmelon. She has been awarded numerous grants through foundations such as the Pollock Krasner Foundation, the New York Foundation of the Arts, the Rima Hort Mann Foundation, and the Tiffany Foundation. Valerie's work has shown internationally with solo exhibitions in London, New York, and Chicago, and she has been commissioned for a public sculpture on the High Line in New York. Her work has been included in significant group exhibitions throughout New York, including Artist Space, the Drawing Center, White Columns, and MoMA PS1. And as I think many of you have heard mentioned, her 2012 exhibition, Alternative Histories, at the Brooklyn Museum was met with much curiosity and enthusiasm by the museum visitors as well as the staff, with high praise from curator Eugenie Tessay, who incidentally curated the exhibition Kehinde Wiley that's in our second floor galleries and was in conversation with Wiley for the first Tuesday evening lecture this season. Dr. Tessay admired the exhibition's creative and unabashed address of manifest destiny and the destruction of colonization in its reference to displacement of nature and people. I have to say that tonight I am really appreciating Valerie's commitment to sharing her work and discussing ideas in contemporary art, as she spent all day yesterday and much of today visiting studios, engaging students and faculty, and presenting her own work at TCU before being here tonight to present what she has titled Valerie Haggerty, Reverse Archaeology, the Creation and Decay of Other Uncanny Transformations. So please join me in welcoming Valerie Haggerty.
Thank you, Terry, for the great introduction, and thank you all for coming. Some of you I met with today at TCU, and you heard my artist talk yesterday, so I applaud you for coming again for round two. And thanks especially to the faculty at TCU, who have been wonderful in hosting me. Special shout out to Adam Fung and Mark Thistlewaite for being wonderful hosts. And I was happy I could come to the Modern tonight to do the talk. I'm really honored to be here. It's a beautiful museum. So, without further ado, I am going to show you the past 10 years of my work, which is essentially my art career at this point. I graduated from the Art Institute of Chicago in 2002, and so this first image is from my graduate studio. And I was interested in this idea of the gallery space being this clean white cube that is not supposed to detract from the artwork and be sort of neutral, clean of history. And at the time in graduate school, things were, there was an emphasis, I think, on conceptualism and minimalism at the time. And so we were spending a lot of time cleaning our spaces and painting our walls white to put the work on. So I thought I'd do the reverse. And maybe, and I felt like romanticism was kind of frowned on. So I thought I'd do something sort of sentimental and romantic and messy with the actual space. So I thought I'd make it into a ruin so that this idea of the clean gallery space would be sort of turned on its head. And this is just based on what was in my idea of the idea of sort of a sentimental domestic ruin. And it's all created out of paper mache and cardboard. So in essence, it was like a collage, except it was done on the interior of the space. And so they're just painted paper glued on top of cardboard. And then I went back and sort of dug into it and ripped it to make it look more in a ruined state. And this was leading up to the graduate exhibition, which I know some of you at TCU are starting to think about, too. It's a lot of pressure in graduate school to think about how you're going to present 2 years of your life and your thought process and your work. And again, as we were all trying to figure out what we were going to show, I thought, well, what if I just made an empty room somehow, reversed again this idea of trying to present this work, but have the work actually be the creation of an empty space. So I actually had a white cube space. This was a clean gallery space. And I went home and measured everything in my kitchen. I'm going to try to use a laser pointer here. So I went and measured everything in my kitchen. So this, then I went and cut pieces of paper to the size of where everything touched the wall and floor. So this would be where my stove was. This was where my sink was, the cabinets were. And I cut all these pieces of paper ahead of time to the size of where all the objects were and painted them and then went into the space. I did all the tiles on the floor, too. So I had a whole stack of paper tiles I made to the exact size of the tiles in my kitchen. I went in for a couple days and glued this all to the walls and floor, let it dry, and then went back with a scraper and peeled it all off again. So it had the effect that the room had been gutted and was previously a domestic space. It was quite labor-intensive. It was very detailed and painterly, and at the same time, people often shut the door at the exhibition because they thought the room was forgotten to be cleaned or wasn't supposed to be open, that it was an abandoned space. So I kind of thought that was humorous, that it was disregarded at the same time. It was quite a laborious piece. And it sort of reminded me of an erased drawing, too. Like, I often think about the erased de Kooning, this idea of going back and sort of taking off all these layers. And there's other artists that were working with this idea of the empty gallery space or sort of an institutional critique of the gallery space. There's Eve Klein, who had an exhibition called The Void in 1958, where he cleaned out the vitrine in the gallery and made sure the walls were clean and white and said it was a show of invisible artworks. And it was like the aura of the presence of the artworks that you were imagining that was the show. Maurizio Catalan in 1989 hung Torno Subito sign on the gallery door, which means be back soon, and the gallery was empty, and he never came back. And so that was the show. You would show up and just, like, look at the sign and then go home. And he also reported the theft of an invisible art show to the Italian police as another show one time. Simon Pope more recently did an exhibition where the gallery was empty, empty pedestals and walls, and the idea was the viewer would walk through and recall their memories of other art objects and shows they had seen. So once I left school, I was continuing with this line of work, and I was calling it reverse archaeology. And I would create a lot of the components in my studio and then go to the space to install it. So this was the first large show of this type of work I did outside of school at Gallery 400 at University of Illinois in Chicago. And this is just to show you it actually was a regular, clean gallery space. And then this was what my exhibition looked like. So half the gallery space was empty. You kind of saw this at the back. It was a very, very large space. And it was based on the lobby of my apartment building at the time. So I went and I measured all the architectural detail, all the tile, the fireplace, the bricks, the windows, cut and painted all this paper, and then went into the space and glued it on the walls. So like the black molding on the bottom is just a strip of paper. All the tiles are squares of paper painted pink and black. The windows on the right, those arched windows, were based on the windows in the in my personal apartment lobby space. And it's just strips of cardboard that I stapled on the wall and then paper mache'd over it. So the The effect was, it's very realistic until you start looking closely and realizing everything is paper thin. So you're walking into a drawing or a collage. And I was really interested in Rachel Whiteread at the time, who works with, if you're familiar with her work, casting empty spaces, usually in domestic spaces. So she may cast the underside of a chair. She pours concrete into these spaces. And she did a really large piece where she cast the interior of a domestic home. So this is the piece called House, and then peeled off the exterior. So you had these reversals where the windows used to be and the doorways used to be, everything's inverted. And I thought what I was doing was interesting, like in thinking about what she's doing with space and the uncanniness of this form that starts to look like almost like a gravestone. It's very hermetic and uncanny in this way that you're not used to seeing a very familiar space. And Do Ho Sa was another artist I was interested in. He's Korean-American, and he's known for sewing these interiors that are based on his American home apartment and his Korean home, and he'll sometimes sew them together or show one inside the other. So he's creating this interior with these soft walls that I think are really interesting and have a psychological effect, also talking about migration. So he is sort of, he was somebody I was interested in thinking about also. These are just, some more shots. And this piece probably took 2 weeks to install, like 12-hour days, and like dragging any friend who would come with me. And it was up for 2 weeks. And that, you know, as a student or as somebody right out of school, the bonus of doing something that's not on view for very long is you have the documentation. And I actually got quite a lot of grants after this and residencies from just the images. So even though things may have a short run, they can have a longer run for other reasons. I was interested in this writing Walter Benjamin did about the Angel of History based on this image print from Paul Klee on the left, and talking about this idea of progress, which I was thinking with these peeling paper spaces I was making, in terms of them being these spaces we often see that are in transition with gentrification and after seeing all this imagery from Detroit and other cities that are decaying, we're kind of used to seeing this imagery now. So it's sort of ubiquitous, and it's like these spaces are kind of disappearing while these new, more modern, contemporary things are going up. So the Angel of History is, Walter Benjamin was describing this idea that this angel was getting propelled into the future, but was facing the past. So it was moving forward with the sweep of progress, but it was watching all this debris pile up behind it, all this destruction that was sort of happening at the same time. This is like a more cheesy illustration of that. Anthony Vidler's an architect who writes about uncanny spaces and some of these ideas that I really like, if any of this is interesting in terms of, he has a book called The Architectural Uncanny that's one of my favorites. And this idea of this anxiety sweeping away the past in favor of the future leaves the present necessarily uncertain. Like, I think the work I make is in response to that also. And I'm interested in this idea of the uncanny, where something familiar can also be strange. And I always think of Robert Gober as a great example of that. So these sinks he's famous for that he hand makes without the faucets and with just the holes where the faucets would be. So it starts to look like a ghost or a tomb, I think is a great example of that. And these pieces are quite uncanny when you walk into them and you start to realize none of the architectural detail has any weight to it, and you're kind of walking into this this space that's different than what you thought it would be. This is just an installation shot to show a bit of the process. So I'll often make sections on fabric so that I can glue the fabric. I can put it together faster instead of gluing all these individual tiles. I did a lot of this work in my studio in sections. And then I'd go into the gallery and glue down these squares. And I do it with big buckets of wallpaper paste, because once you wet it, you can peel it up again, so it's not like a permanent glue. And this wall now probably has four layers of paper on it, but at the end I paint it white. So usually when I'm installing the gallery, people will come back after 4 days and it looks like I haven't done anything and then I start looking like I'm digging into the wall. And I like that about the work, that it looks subtractive, but it's actually additive to the piece. This was another work in that vein done at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago that I don't know if they still do it, but they have they had a room called the 12 by 12 where they showed a new emerging artist, I think each month. And I was trying to think of a particularly like disturbing space to see in a contemporary modern building. And that's the best context, I think, for this work, is a clean contemporary space. It's more jarring, because often people might, galleries will call or museums and be like, we have a decaying basement and we thought of you. And I think, well, just sign my name. Like, I don't have to do it, you know? But like when you go in a space like that, that's very controlled, so you don't ever see like what's really happening behind the scenes in terms of how the building might be falling apart or things that need to get fixed. So I thought like a dirty public bathroom would be pretty shocking in that context. And I based it on my bathroom in the Art Institute studio building at the time. But it didn't look this bad. it was definitely falling apart, but not like this. So the toilet and the sink are made out of paper mache. The pipes are, even the pipes hanging from the ceiling I added, and they're also cracked and breaking apart, and they're all just a layer of paper mache. So once people would do a double take, like walking by the room, they'd sort of like walk by and glance in and then like be like, whoa, and like go back. And once you started looking, getting up closer, you'd realize that the illusion would fall apart and you'd realize it was actually an artwork, not an actual space. And then I was thinking about this class I took on Chinese archaeology in grad school, that this one story where they were talking about when they first started excavating China, they were finding these vessels that were made out of this incredibly thin porcelain in a way that was very difficult to make. And then if you actually used the bowl or the vase, it would just break. So they were confused why they would go to so much trouble to make these objects that were not functional but looked like functional objects. And they realized they were objects to show the gods what to build in the afterlife for the person. So that in essence, they were almost like these three-dimensional maps. And some of the things would be like horses and soldiers. And as long as they were to scale, they could be miniaturized. So it's almost like the gods could blow them up as long as they had the right proportions. And I love that idea that they were these drawings in preparation for this transformation and to become this other thing that was needed in a different plane of existence. And in Eastern countries now, they still have that tradition where you can bury these things, but they're updated, so they're not vases or dishes. They're like iPads and cell phones and speakers made out of paper. And they're really interesting objects to look at. So again, I would leave part of the space white, as if this space was almost a bit of a mirage that eventually would turn back to the clean white wall. And this was another thing I had read in a book about conservation in Eastern countries. Like with Shinto temples, often the oldest ancient buildings are actually the newest, because they, instead of how we do in the West, where we kind of put a rope around things and like try to keep it in the same state, they'll pass down the tradition about how to do the painting and the carving and the the building, and they'll replace things as they rot. So I love that idea that there's this tradition of recreation, but it's about a living past. I think in the book it compared it to almost like cells in the body that are regenerating. And I was interested in that and thinking about recreation in my work as this idea of exploring the past, but through this lens of the present. And this was a piece at the Drawing Center called Childhood Bedroom, and this was based on my bedroom as a child. My parents still live in the same home, and at the time I called my mom and had her fax me all the measurements of my bedroom, and I rebuilt the window and the door to scale out of cardboard. And when I was very young, my bedroom was pink, and then as a teenager it was blue, and as an adult it was yellow. And then I layered up these layers of colored paper until the yellow was on the top, as if that was the current state of the walls. And the exhibition was emphasizing process, so every week I would go in and scrape at the walls as if trying to dig through and find this state of the room with the pink walls, which I remembered from when I was the youngest. And so the piece went through kind of visually all these changes until the exhibition was in its final week, and I left it sort of in this state. And it was reminding me a lot, too, of about the mark making an abstract expressionist painting, especially Clifford Still, that it almost had that same look to it. And I liked thinking about this as a painting. The Drawing Center was thinking of it as a drawing. And I like thinking of the work in that way. I was saying when I gave the talk yesterday that, again, like the work is very confusing to people. And so this guy at the opening came up to me and he just looked really confused and awestruck. And he was like, "I can't believe you found your bedroom under the walls of the Drawing Center." And like, I couldn't tell if he thought I used to live there or like, he looked really confused, but he looked really like astonished. And it was just kind of great. Cause I'm like, I have no idea what he thinks, but he believes something magical happened. And then I was doing this work and, working with a gallery, and they were saying, we want to take your work to an art fair, but you're not allowed to glue anything to the wall. And so I was thinking, well, since I'm sort of critiquing like the exhibition space, what else could I work with besides the wall and the floor? And the obvious answer was artwork. So I went back to the gallery and asked if any of the other artists could give me one of their pieces and we could like collaborate. And they were saying, you know, nobody wants to give you a piece of their art so that you can rip it apart. So why don't you just make your own artwork? And I was thinking, I love landscape painting, and I was thinking about this idea of the painting on the wall being a window or a portal to this other place, and it's very civilized and contained. You stand at the painting and you look into it. And I was thinking, well, what if that interaction between the viewer and the gallery is more aggressive, like nature isn't sitting in this nice box, it's actually breaking into the space. So I did a few pieces that looked like these trees were breaking through the walls. They're just these papier-mâché pieces that are placed on the wall and then papier-mâchéed over. So the wall is actually not damaged or broken. It's kind of on top of it. And even the floor that's peeling up, it's just pieces of cardboard painted to match the floor. And this was a piece I did at PS1. And it was funny because the people who their job at night is to mop the floor, they came up to me at the opening and they thought it was hilarious because they came in to mop the floor and they're like, "Where did this tree come from overnight?" And they thought it was the funniest thing. So it was interesting, like thinking about who spends a lot of time in the museum and knows these spaces really well is the people who clean them. And they often throw out my artwork by accident. Like I'll have to tape things off and write this is art and all these things like in preparation for the people who are coming at night to clean. But and also thinking about like this illusion of the stability or the importance of the institution and this idea of stability, and that the tree is sort of breaking through the foundation and opening up like an inquiry or a crack in that idea. And also that there was probably a tree there before the building was built, and there'll probably be a tree there at some point if the building falls down, and sort of this collapsing of time with that idea. So back to the art fair, I was like trying to think of what to do for the art fair, and I had seen these two images in a newspaper in the New York Times, these two articles that were side by side coincidentally, and one of them was about a military graveyard in Iraq, so it was showing these armored vehicles that were full of holes, and next to it was a picture of a woodpecker, and talking about the sighting of an ivory-billed woodpecker that was thought to have been extinct. And woodpeckers have been going extinct from, again, this spread of progress and with a lot of early logging efforts. So I like that idea of this other result of progress being war, and this perhaps thinking about the spread of democracy to other countries or other things in modern society that are causing wars. And so I was, again, thinking about these early American landscape paintings that often are talked about in art history in terms of manifest destiny, this idea that that settlers, white settlers, it was a sort of preordained to spread westward, that God gave the go-ahead, and it was very abundant, and there was a lot of resources at hand, and often there was sort of the spiritual light pointing to the west, and very idealized view of pristine nature. And so I took that painting and I copied it large scale. This is about, it's probably about 9 feet wide and 6 or 7 feet high, and wanted it to look like it was shot through with gunfire. Because often we don't see like historical American work damaged by war. So I kind of wanted it to look like war damage. But then after you looked around for a while, you realized there was a little woodpecker up in the right-hand corner, and it was that little bird that was the culprit. This was the collector who bought it, hung it in their dining room, which was like absolutely perfect for the work. And I had painted the painting in acrylic on foam core, and then went back with X-Acto knives and carved holes in it, which was actually quite hard to do because I took months to copy it, and I was really proud because I don't normally do like a good realistic painting, and was sort of really proud of my copy, so it was actually kind of painful to go back and cut holes in it, and created the woodpecker out of paper mache. And so I like the idea that woodpeckers are looking for infestation. They're looking for insects that have infested woods. So I like the idea that somehow there's an implication that this imagery or something about the work is infested. And also the woodpecker could be fooled by the realism, by how well I've painted it, that it thought the trees were actually real trees and was thinking about it in that way. Or there's this implication of self-destruction, that the woodpecker could have actually flown out of this environment and sort of turned on its own environment. And then I did another show, like thinking about seascape painting, which has a lot of these same ideas in it about expansionism. And I had found this book catalog for the show in the Whitney called Seascape in the American Imagination, and using a lot of furniture and artwork in that genre. And so I used that as reference to recreate some of the artwork and then make it look like it had been hit by some devastating flood or been in, on a ship that had sunk. And I often use Thomas Cole, The Course of the Empire, as a reference. He has, The Course of the Empire is 5 paintings of a same view of a landscape going through what he considered 5 stages of history. And the first one is the savage state, where things are more wild. He considered the pastoral state sort of the perfect harmony, very like European looking, between man and nature. And then there's the consummation of the empire, where there's the growth of the city and riches and gluttony, and which eventually leads to destruction with war and natural catastrophe. And it leaves the final stage called desolation, which is the city in ruins. There's no sign of human life, but nature's taking back over. And I often think of my work in this stage. And the implication that the cycle's going to keep going again, but maybe in a slightly different way. So I like think of my work as sort of the breakdown of this idea of culture versus nature, but the implication that there's, with the destruction, there's also room for rebirth in some form. And these are just more shots from this show, the Seascape show. This was a fireplace based on one in a catalog of from the Met. This is in the period room at the Met. George Washington on a stick, as if he had been maybe scooped out of the swamp. Seascape painting, as if the sea imprinted an image of itself by creating the driftwood. And constructed destruction. I like the idea that the decay is actually constructed. And I had put this in for students, but if you're interested in deconstructed artwork and the more historical people working in that way, this is a great was a great show and catalog, Painting Under Attack. This is an early American armoire that was in a show in London in 2007, again with the woodpecker idea. George Washington chopped. This is using a poster. Sometimes I use posters. Cracked canyon, as if this other canyon's going through the canyon. This is a group show shot in Chelsea, and I really like this shot because my work's the crack on the wall, so I spent 2 days making that. And I like it as sort of this, it looks like, it, because it is an object too, and it's in this grouping with other objects, but then it also looks like a subtraction at the same time. And it's not, I'm not cutting the wall, like I added paper mache to it, and I paint the interior black so it looks like that, but it's actually very object-like. Gordon Matta-Clark, who some of you may know, is somebody I look to a lot, and he was actually physically cutting into buildings in the 60s and 70s, and it's very, like this type of work, it's very, there's a lot of like macho gesture going on with the physicality of it. So I like thinking about my work in contrast, where it's like sort of a crafty maneuver versus, if you ever see the video of him doing that, he's like got no shirt on and a bandana and a chainsaw and just like going at the house. It's really a great video. And thinking about like the psychological implications, like there's a gothic interest or edge to my work, and thinking about the House of Usher, where I think they bury the sister alive by accident or something, and then eventually the house cracks in half and sinks into the swamp. So the idea that something repressed is causing the, is becoming unveiled and causing the destruction. This was another cracked canyon piece I did at Artist Space, and it's with a poster, a Moran poster of the Grand Canyon, and I had put this in because there had been an art form review, and the reviewer had written that I had very cleverly used a crack that I found in the wall to make the piece, and I just thought it was funny because I had made the crack, and that confusion is, I think, kind of interesting. And interested in the idea of the sublime, this sort of awe of nature, but also terror of nature, and how it was talked about in early American painting with these grand sites like the Grand Canyon or Niagara Falls, and that and how you would feel standing in front of one of these sites with the grandeur and kind of terror of the grandeur of nature. And then thinking about the sublime in terms of climate change and these catastrophes that are happening because of the environment, and I'm like interested in that comparison. This is a piece called Niagara Falls, based on a beer stat, as if it maybe had gone over the falls itself. In 2009, I did a public commission on the High Line. If some of you may have been there, it's a it used to be an abandoned railroad track on the west side of Manhattan. It was abandoned maybe in the 80s and sort of closed up, and it just grew wild with nature for years until fairly recently they decided to renovate it and reconstruct it into a public park. So this was the piece I created, and I was thinking about the, it was used to ship goods from upstate New York into Chelsea, and eventually the last train car went, I think, with like a cartload of frozen turkeys, I had read, because interstate trucking had taken over the railroad. So eventually the last train car ran, and I was thinking, like, what if at the same time this painting like fell off the truck and was left to the elements. And it's a Hudson River Valley painting. And the Hudson River Valley paintings were extremely popular in their time. And then at some point they fell out of favor when Impressionism became popular. And so this idea of going back up to the High Line and discovering this space, but also discovering this painting and reevaluating this painting that has now had its own transformation, where the stretcher bars have grown back into branches and it's becoming part of the landscape itself. And the view is of this idealized view of the Hudson River. It's based on a Cropsey painting. And so when you look through the holes in the painting, you're actually looking out on the Hudson River in its industrialized state. So I like that layering of the history there. And Magritte is a favorite of mine, not only for his unusual juxtapositions, but also how he's often referencing the act of painting. And I like these paintings where he's putting the canvas in front of the window. So there's like multiple portals going on in this idea of like this map of what's underneath on top. And this was the piece going through different seasons. And I mean, normally my work's made out of paper mache. So they said, you know, you have to figure out how to, they gave me a budget and said, you have to figure out how to make it in a way that it's going to last through a year of the elements and be indestructible to 12-year-old boys. Like, that's like their main problem with public art. And so I hired a friend who worked at the Bronx Zoo, and her job is making fake trees. And she was saying, we were trying to, you know, I was consulting with her about what material to use. And she was saying, well, at the zoo, we use this thing called zoopoxy, and it's because the monkeys will break and climb and eat everything, but they can't break zoopoxy. So we were like, monkeys, 12-year-old boys, no offense to 12-year-old boys who might be here. Like, that'll work. So we made it out of that. And, yeah, the people thought the piece was decaying over time, but it actually always remained the same. And this was a large-scale piece I did at Locust Projects in Miami, which is a site-specific installation space that does a lot of great things, unusual projects. And I did this work kind of going back to the earlier work with the reverse archaeology. It was based on a Miami interior that I looked at on the internet. And then thinking about Gordon Matta Clark and how he cuts these holes in the wall. So that's a reference to him in the back with the hole cut out. And I used a photograph. I hired somebody in Miami to take a photograph of the beach and put that behind these layers of foam core and paper. But the one thing I wanted to try, because they encouraged you to try something different there, was to make an illusion of a hole in the floor. And I was thinking about Urs Fischer, who's a contemporary artist, and he actually physically dug out this hole in the floor with a bulldozer in Chelsea. And sort of, again, that macho, like, earthwork gesture of physically altering the work in that way, the environment in that way. And then I was thinking about, well, how am I going to do it? And I thought, like, sidewalk artists do these paintings that look like these illusions of holes. So I was like looking up sidewalk artists, and this is the one guy that like seems to be pretty pretty well regarded in terms of being a sidewalk artist. And so I was trying to figure out how they make this illusion. And what I liked about it is that the illusion only works from one vantage point. So once you walk around it, it falls back into this abstract painting. So the floor was actually not altered. I just made this painting on the floor. And the most famous anamorphic, it's a distortion that you have to look at it from a certain angle for it to snap into three dimensions. And the most famous anamorphic painting in art history is the Holbein skull, which you can see that distortion at the bottom, which is a very strange painting. But apparently if you stand in front of the painting and look up from the right-hand corner, it will merge back into three dimensions. And I made these paper mache birds as if they had sort of like flown in from the exterior. And here's an image of Gordon Matta-Clark doing his circular cuts. And there was the sidewalk artist, there's always one point where people stand to get their picture taken, and that was like the place to stand for the shot. So like during the opening, people would stand there to get their picture taken. I'm interested in magic realism in writing, and these were some definitions I found when I looked online, like believable but impossible, I think a lot about with my work, that it often contains a critique of society, especially the elite, like that is something I think about a lot with my work. And I like to seize the mystery that breathes behind things so that there's something like being revealed or something that's hidden, that's being exposed. And so this is melted, George Washington melted, and thinking about that story, The Portrait of Dorian Gray, if you read it, by Oscar Wilde, where a young, beautiful man sells his soul to stay young and beautiful forever, but he starts creating doing these heinous deeds, and every time he does, he notices that that's reflected in the painting decaying. So I liked playing with that idea, with this image of George Washington and like things that might be done under the name of nationalism that are more hidden or repressed, kind of bubbling up through his portrait. And I did a bunch of works with George Washington, so I kind of threw them in a row. George Washington shipwrecked, headless George Washington with table. This one is a repeat, George Washington eroded. And sort of playing with two, like how far can you alter or take away the image until it becomes an abstraction, or, you know, that you can still read his face even though it's been disfigured in that way. This was another armoire called Shipwrecked Armoire with barnacles that was in a more recent show, as if it had somehow fallen off a ship and been exposed to the ocean. Sinking ship. Then I did a more recent show based on some ideas from still life and history and in current events. So thinking about banquet and vanitas still lifes from art history, the banquet still lifes often show this overabundance and sort of moral messages about gluttony, and vanitas still life talking about impermanence and the passage of time. So there's often a candle burning down or a skull, or some of the fruit will be starting to rot. And kind of thinking about those to create the work. And so this was a vanitas still life I did at an art fair, where I thought I would sort of pump up that idea of the momentum mori and have these crows being trying to eat the painting. And these are copies of Raphael Peale paintings of raw meat. And also thinking about at art fairs, like there's this frenzy of people like picking apart the artwork, trying to figure out like what's the best artwork or the best artist. So that idea of the frenzy of consuming the artworks. And there's also the myth of Zeus and Parrhasis, where they had a contest to figure out who is the best painter. And so Zeus has painted an image of fruit, and it attracted birds who tried to peck at the painting, so they thought he was the winner. And they turned to Parrhasis and said, "Well, pull back your curtain so we can see your painting." And his painting was actually the curtain. So he won the contest, because even though Zeus has fooled the birds, Parrhasis fooled the other artists. So like sort of playing with that idea too of like who is the best painter. And thinking about Edgar Allan Poe is a favorite with The Raven, and Alfred Hitchcock with The Birds, kind of the cinematic quality to the work, too. Raphael Peale's a favorite of mine. I think he really gets this sort of bodily aspect of the fruit in his paintings. There's something very eerie about it. And in 2012, there were all these news articles about exploding watermelons. In Mexico and China, they had been sprayed with the wrong growth hormone, so the insides grew faster than the outsides. And I thought that was so strange and Frankensteinian, this sort of trying to alter nature, but there's this backlash. So this inspired Watermelon Tongue. I was trying to make a painting that looked like the insides were growing, and then it started to look like a tongue. And that seemed to work well, too, like the fruit was taunting the viewer. Like, this is what happens, like, when you're trying to mess with me. And I liked, this is probably the most surreal piece I've made, I think. And I, at the time, I was also reading The Botany of Desire, which is a great book about this altering of food to fit our desires better, but also the food and plants alter on their own to try to attract us. So that idea of, like, who's really in charge here. And he wrote this book talking about there's the apple, the tulip, marijuana, and the potato, and how they all reflect different desires on our parts and how that went awry at a certain point. And one of the chapters is on the tulip and thinking about this pursuit of beauty and this huge financial bubble that was formed by trying to buy these certain tulips that were bred a certain way. And one of the tulip attributes that was very attractive and expensive was the stripes. And they're actually caused by a virus. And so that reminded me of Botox, this like pursuit of beauty, but using bacteria or viruses to create something, but then it goes wrong at some point or may go wrong. So this is based on a Dutch still life, as if it was getting bigger and more beautiful, but then got out of control and like scarier and started taking over the wall and the space. And also like thinking about Little Shop of Horrors, which is kind of a similar narrative actually. This was another painting in the show, Exploded Peaches. And also thinking about like action painting and like throwing paint so that the explosions actually make another painting on the wall. And that when there's like a whole shot through the image of the peach, it kind of explodes into paint. And then this is the last project I'll talk about. I did in 2013 three site-specific installations in the early American period rooms, which was kind of like a dream venue for me to try out with this work. And so I was allowed to choose three rooms, and this was one of the rooms I chose, the plantation. It was a plantation dining room, so from South Carolina. And if you've haven't been to these rooms in the Brooklyn Museum, you can't actually go in them. They have windows and doors, and you have to peer through glass, so they're like a bit removed, as if you're looking in these kind of historical dioramas. So this is what the room looked like when I was given it. And this is another space I used, the Cupola House Hall from North Carolina, and this is the Cupola. This is the same room, actually. And I was allowed to remove any objects or furniture or dishware and then put in my own. This is another room from the Cupola House. And I was taking on a tour like through the rooms, and they would explain, like, this rug is historic, but it's not actually from this house. It's what we think might be in a house like this at the time, or this object isn't actually from here, but, like, we want to put it up during this exhibition. This couch has been reupholstered last year. You know, so there was this mix. Like, there was nothing about it that was actually true. It was kind of this imagined scenario, and I thought that was really interesting in terms of a historic room. And the Cupola House was sort of a really interesting story where the Brooklyn Museum purchased the rooms. The house had fallen into disrepair. The Brooklyn Museum bought the rooms and had them shipped to Brooklyn. A few years later, the town realized that they wanted to save the house, but now they didn't have the interiors. So they recreated the interiors in the historic home, and the Brooklyn Museum has the real interiors. And I thought that was sort of fascinating, too. So I played on that crow idea and the idea of the body breaking apart, wanting to show, you know, they're sort of showing the European side of the historic story, but there's no indication about the slave labor behind the plantation in that room. So I thought I'd indicate some disruption in the room, have the crows stand in for like a veil of blackness. There's Jim Crow laws. This idea that the crows are maybe rebelling and attacking this feast. I had the chairs jumbled as if the table guests had to leave in a hurry. And trying to make it look very violent in a way, but very painterly at the same time. And there were two paintings of fruit that the crows were also eating. And then in the Cupola House, one of the Cupola House rooms, I expanded on the woodpecker idea. So when you looked in the window, you saw these holes shot through the dishware. I replaced some of the dishware with my own and recreated a Thomas Cole painting with a woodpecker. And then also a table and a chair I copied somewhat from the room and made it look like it was also getting pecked by a woodpecker. So you'd have to look in the window and try to figure out what was going on for a while before you located the woodpeckers. And then there was a cabinet with dishware, and I pulled out some of theirs and put some of mine in. And then the final room, I wanted to make some commentary on Native American history, and I did another George Washington portrait. This time his head is finally completely removed and placed on the couch. I had told this story yesterday, but I was a little worried the Brooklyn Museum might think this was a little controversial or shocking, and so, because this was kind of a last-minute addition, so I sort of, like, went and checked in, like, is there any issue with George Washington's decapitated head on the couch? And they said, you know, as long as you don't put any glitter on it, because glitter is really hard to get out of upholstery. And I thought that was really funny that they didn't... They didn't micromanage the project or try to tone down any of the content. They would kind of just let me go, and I just showed up and installed, and that was it. There's George. And I ordered this Native American pattern rug off the internet and then cut it up and sewed it with raffia, all these palm tree fronds they sell in florist stores, and wanted to think about this idea of this fight over the land and things getting divided into territories, and then also seeing these different strata of the one type of architecture with the wooden floorboards under the carpet, and sort of thinking about this layering and who was where first. And then the final piece was this Indian chief, Sheritarish. There was a series of Indian portraits painted under Monroe where they invited, you can see the medallion on his neck. They gave them all like a little presidential medal with Monroe's portrait on it, and then painted the chief's portraits and sort of told them that, you know, we should all like cooperate and be friends, but really they were trying to show off the military might so that the Indians would know, like, that they were kind of the American military was sort of a strong force. So I was thinking about this idea where George's head is maybe taken off, like perhaps by some retaliatory act, but the Indian chief's head is growing. I was reading some Native American mythology. There's a lot of shape-shifting with nature, and that idea of it becoming part of the tree so that the growth is... thinking about cultural identity, maybe somewhat painful, but like integrated into the portrait. And show is up for 8 months at the Brooklyn Museum. And so this is where I'm going to end. And Yeah, that's where I'm going to end. Thank you. I know we're like close to eight. If anybody had any questions, sure. Yep. Mm-hmm.
With all the work you put into your installations, how simple is it to take it down where you still have it in a hole where you can put it up again?
Originally, I would just throw it away. Like, I hadn't figured out how to do that. And then, I did a piece recently, and I basically staple Tyvek, which is a waterproof paper, to the wall first. And I staple that up on the wall and glue it to the floor, and then I make the layers of paper on top of that. So I can actually go in and just take one edge and just walk along the wall and pull the whole thing off and roll it up. I reinstalled the piece two more times, and in its final state, I told the museum just to throw it away. Like, I reinstalled it in California the third time, and every time it was disintegrating because of the fragility of the painted paper. So those bigger wall installations, I tend not to try to save. Sometimes I'll reinstall them a couple times, and then they just get recycled or thrown away. Some of the work where it's like a painting getting looks like it's getting integrated into the wall, I usually make it so the painting can be separated. And a lot of times if someone buys it, they just want the painting. They don't want the wall part. Like, we always say, like, I can come to your house and do that to your wall. And they usually are like, we'll just do it this way for now. it's kind of liberating to not save stuff, too. Because it's very stressful to try to preserve things that are made out of paper and large. Yeah.
So I'm interested in looking at the work that you presented. Sort of almost tells a kind of story from a body of work that was about self.
Yeah.
And spaces you inhabited, mm-hmm. to ending with this work, which takes on questions of national identity.
Yeah.
And I'm curious about that shift. The stakes are different.
Yeah.
So if you could talk a little bit about whether that was a conscious maneuver or a product. Did it come about because of the projects you were invited to participate in?
Right. It was probably... It started out like that because I was working with rooms, it was easy for me to reference spaces I was in. And then once I had to make that first painting for an art fair... I didn't want to make my own painting. I just wanted a painting, so I thought I'll just do something historic. And then I think that started this trajectory. But I was saying this yesterday at TCU. I grew up on the East Coast in a small town very close to Concord and Lexington. So we were always learning about the Revolutionary War. And my family, my grandparents are from Italy and Ireland, but we don't have any, we grew up in a fake colonial house. There were fake Revolutionary War artifacts everywhere, and I thought they were real. And even the beams in the house look like these huge old trees, but actually they're 2x4s all stacked together and carved to look like. And so I think I grew up with this recreated history about early America that was kind of something I think immigrant families hooked onto. My dad bought all these landscape paintings that look like early American landscape paintings from the hardware store. The guy in the hardware store painted them in the back. So we sort of have these I thought they were just big famous paintings, but they're just these reproductions that somebody made. So I think it's, even though it's, I'm talking about this historical narrative, it's still personal in a way. But I think about what you're talking about a lot. And so since 2013, I've wanted to make a shift in my work. I kind of want to make my own paintings. You can get very boxed in with what you do and who invites you to do things. And museums were calling to get me to do something in the museum, some intervention with a painting that already existed. And I was just starting, oh no, am I going to be that person? Is this what I'm going to do? So I feel like the work I'm doing now, it's maybe going a little bit back to the personal, although the historic references are still in there, but maybe not as direct in a way. But that is, I do like coming from a personal place, and I think, but I want it to be open, and I think working with domestic spaces is something other people can enter into, I guess, depending on where they're from, because they're generally like American-looking, you know, apartment spaces. But yeah, I think it's coming, the narratives with early American history was coming from a bit of a personal place, but I am trying to do something new the past couple of years. Yep.
So you're working through a variety of styles, mm-hmm. and exploring them and being in a dialogue with them. But you didn't fall upon a label for your own style. And that seems deliberate, kind of an erasure there. But do you have a label for your style?
I don't, what do you, like, what would you use as a label? Like, what do you mean by label?
Mm-hmm. There's a term, now there's a site on the internet called Cipher Structure, and I think Cipher Structure would be a good label for that.
Oh, okay.
Style, because that's kind of what I'm doing. You have a structure, but it's cipher, and it's knocked out and distorted and transformed, and everything is going on with it.
Right.
So there's a great deal of play. Once you have a model, you can then do whatever the heck you want to with it. And I see you thinking through that and grappling with those kinds of models. And, you know, very much, if I were looking at this in earlier history, it would definitely fall into the postmodern.
Right.
And especially mm-hmm. a reference to romanticism and ruin.
Yeah.
And the bringing forth of that. But there are additional elements that have now crept into that just because of the force of history and what's going on. And you're in dialogue with earlier artists who've already done that, and you're bringing your own perspective and your own nuance.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like people will label things differently. And there's the new term, ruin porn, that people were using. And then I'd go give a lecture and they're like, is that ruin porn? Like, are you fetishizing decay? And, I don't know. I don't like labels in general.
That's good, because you're definitely, you're showing labels, but it's kind of your method to kind of stick them up there for a moment. Like, okay, I realized it, now I'm going to pull it back off the wall, and a little bit of the print ghost itself into the wall. That's cool, but I'm not going to leave everything exposed.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So you give a sense of what you're doing, and then you sort of cover it up.
Right.
The other hand.
So maybe I'm an eraser.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How many people work with you when you put the thing together?
I often work alone. If I can drag a friend along, great. If I have a little money, I'll pay somebody. I was teaching last year, so I got to have students who were like happy to come with me. I don't like have a big production crew. I do a lot alone. And the work I'm doing now is much smaller. Like, I'm sort of losing interest in these grand, giant vignettes and sort of thinking about how to have this content on a smaller scale. And I'm taking a ceramics class, so I'm like learning this new medium that I'm interested in working with ceramics. So, I think it's part of like being younger too. Like, you have a lot more energy. I mean, I'm still energetic, but like, I'm sort of like, yeah, I don't need to keep doing that. It's nice, like, if some, you know, it's with a place that will provide the help and people are assisting, then it's much easier. But I don't use a lot of assistance usually.
Your work is very good.
Oh, thank you. Maybe we should end there. Thanks so much for coming.